I'm Laura Vinroot Poole. For 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store. Capital has never really been about fashion. It's always been about people. What we wore was created to share the meaningful journeys that inspire me. From the designers and friends I meet on the road to the men and women with whom I work each day.
Everybody wants to know her name.
We spoke with Pierre Maheu, the founder of Officine Générale, from his studio in Paris. You may even hear the chatter of his colleagues at work in the background. Pierre's stories of his childhood by the sea in Brittany and the inception of Officine Générale are very real, yet beautiful, much like his collection. Pierre, welcome to the podcast. So happy to be talking to you this morning. Where am I talking to you?
I'm right now sitting at my desk in the studio, working on the next fall winter 21 collection. We are not on the same side of the ocean. So yes, I'm in Paris. My office / studio is located in the heart of Paris, close to Luxembourg Garden.
I guess you go to Pizza Chic.
I go to Pizza Chic, of course. right now we don't know to be don't go to Pizza Chic because it's closed, of course. But they do take away. It's actually one of my best friends who own it, and that's the best pizza in Paris. So once a week we have a takeaway pizza at night from Pizza Chic with my family. We have to support them.
I know you're French, but did you grow up in Paris?
Yes and no. No, I was born in Brittany, on the west coast of France, in a town called Vannes, a mid-sized town. And I arrived in Paris when I was 10 or 11, I guess. First in the suburbs of Paris, it's called Saint-Germain-en-Laye, a very nice area with a beautiful forest and a whole castle. And then I moved to Paris when I was 16. So knowing that I'm 46, I spent most of my life in Paris, let's say. I feel and ashamed about it, but I feel more Parisian than from Brittany.
Ile de Ré is there, correct?
Ile de Ré is southern of Brittany.
That's the coolest island of all time.
That's a very nice one. But you know, in Brittany, there is some beautiful, there is Belle Isle, there is Watt, there is Groix. My grandmother was born on an island called Groix, just in front of Lorient. And my father was my father and grandfather were oyster producer, and okay. we still have the farmer place, which is literally on the sea in a small in a very small village called Baden. There is no neighbors around. It's just beautiful.
Coming from Vannes, when you came to Paris at 16, I would imagine you'd been here and there as a child, but what was it like when you arrived, and was the style so completely different and inspiring, and what was it like?
When I was in Saint-Germain-en-Laye, I was above of one store. Very soon, when I was like 15, I mean, that was barely legal, I started to work in that store to make some money. They were doing Levi's. They were doing Harris Wilson, Schott. They were doing lots of cool and nice brands, Vans, Converse at that time already. So I was very early in it. You know, the funny thing is, we talk about it, and I was talking about it with one of my friends. Is like, when you look at fashion right now in some parts, it's not really different of what we are wearing. I've never been like in the scare mood or all these kind of things, you know? So we were wearing denims, t-shirts, sweatshirts, crew necks, outerwear, down jacket, things like that. But that's still pretty much the same. I mean, the first expensive things I bought when I was working at 15 was those Western loafer. And that was 30 years ago, basically. I don't have it anymore. I mean, I would love to find it somewhere, but I think I lost them in one of my when I moved from my different apartment, and I threw them away. That was a stupid mistake. But yeah, you know, I mean, it's still very cool loafer that a lot of my friends are wearing actually. There was something in the education, there was something in the DNA where you start wearing something and you basically get old with it, you know? I was wearing white denim at that time. I have one white denim today on me. I don't think I will keep wearing white denim in my life or white t-shirt or a good crew neck merino sweater, you know? That's things that are kind of uniform and that you maybe wear them differently, but I think you keep them on your life.
And I've heard that the men in your life were very stylish. Your father, your grandfather.
They were really, really geometrically opposite, you know. So my father was only wearing denim, chinos, Oxford shirts, and maybe once upon a time a navy blazer, you know. On my father, so my grandfather was a tailor, and that was a totally different story. He was in this tailor shop, and he has also a store where he was selling fabrics, English fabrics, Italian fabrics, whatever, because at that time there was a lot of women that were doing clothes, the dress or skirt for women, you know, handmade and stuff like that. And he was wearing a suit every day. I never saw him in my life with a denim or chino. He had a beautiful house outside of Van, and he was not working any Mondays. And so he was gardening on Mondays and Sunday in his beautiful garden. And he was wearing old suits with old dress shirts and a vest from a three-piece suit. So I remember, and I think this is an image I have on, frankly speaking, not daily, but at least weekly basis. He had a big house, and he had a corridor that it was his wardrobe. And one side was fall, winter, one side was spring, summer.
Wow.
And everything was classified by color. So he had a black tuxedo first in heavy wool and mohair for winter, and he had a summer one. And then on winter, that was the dark gray flannel, the mid gray flannel, then the navy, then the glen plaid, then he was going to some corduroy. And in winter, that was the same thing with some lightweight wool, fresco wool, from the darkest to the lightest. And the last pieces were two or three off-white linen suits. And then he had some ties that were unlined for summer. So a knitted tie or light wool tie, because he was wearing a lot of matching wool with his matching tie with his suit. And on winter, it was heavy wool, flannels, wool and silk, everything. And the shoes also were different, and they were separate on the bottom of below the suit. Everything was classified by season, and the coats and everything. That was really amazing. And also very in what I do now. I mean, there was like one black tuxedo, but the rest were shades of grays and navy, and then some patterns, some houndstooth, some glen plaid. But yeah, in a color palette that was really minimal, and with the dress shirt in white, in blues, in Bengal stripe, navy white, gray. I mean, that was just perfection.
Well, I mean, and it sounds like merchandising 101, but also I don't know if you went to school for design, but I feel like you didn't even need to. Or I'd love to see a picture, but I don't really need a picture because you have painted the most beautiful portrait in my head.
Well, it's I think it's very easy to visualize. I don't even have a picture. I have some suits and jackets from him, but I don't even have a picture of his wardrobe at that time.
Did you spend time in the atelier with your grandfather in his tailor shop?
When I was young, yeah, but I was a small boy, because I left at 10 or 11. So, and I remember exactly the fabrics. I mean, the rolls of camel hair, the rolls of cashmere in coat weight and all that. And he was explaining me the fabrics, where they were coming from. There is some mills I'm still working with that he had in his store at that time. That was I think the first step of my education, I would say. But just looking at him and the few images I have of him working, they are really important and part of of my taste and my DNA. That's for sure. Frankly speaking, I went to school. I stayed exactly 4 days. just because I told them, like, well, this is virtual what we are talking about. When are we starting to really talk about garment construction and fabrics? Because I don't think, and that was a school that was planned on 3 years. And I said, like, I'm not going to stand like 3 years sitting listening to you, because it's not concrete at all. And I need concrete, you know. If you want to learn me stuff, it has to be real, because right now I'm missing techniques, but that's not enough. And then I had big argument with the teacher, and then I was in front of the director 10 minutes after, and he told me, what are you talking about? And then I told them, like, listen, I'm not going to learn anything. It's better for me to do an internship at a tailor or anything else, or go back to Brittany and work with my grandfather, because I'm not going to learn anything from you. And then he told me, you're ready, you can leave if you want. I mean, if you, I said, yeah, okay, fine, I leave. And that was the end. The funny thing is, when I started Officine Générale, 3 years after, they invited me to be a member of their jury, end of year jury.
I can't believe they asked that. How'd you do?
but because they didn't remember. I mean, that was, of course, a new director at that time. And as an upcoming French brand, they invited me, but I denied. I didn't win because I was too busy at that time. But that was the funny end of the story.
When you left school after 3 days and went to intern, did you go directly to intern for someone? And did you have mentors along the way?
Well, that's exactly what I did. You know, I started working for a company called Archer & Fox. At that time, they were pretty big, and the owner of that brand, that Michel Barnes, he invented, like, let's say the half measure. You know, like the industrial measure. Let's say it like that. Mm. And that was end of the 60s, early 70s in Paris. He was dressing all the stars at that time. He was dressing Alain Delon, Jean-Paul Belmondo, and that was something really, really new, because he had fabrics, and then he was making the jacket with few alteration, or the suit with few alteration. And people at that time were ordering like 5, 6, 10, 12 suits. But he was doing all his jacket himself at Caraccini and Anderson and Shepard. And he knew really a lot on tailoring. So he was really a Bible. I learned really a lot with him. I'm still in contact with him, because he has a store right below where I live in Saint-Germain-des-Prés. So I see him on and off. That's someone that's been really, I have a lot of respect for him. And it's funny, because now he comes to the store, he looks at the collection, then he called me and said, I really like, that's good, what you do, it's different. So we have a very nice relationship.
And then from there, you moved on and did, I think, bigger projects, or working for bigger companies?
I did like my self-education, you know. I went in Italy and I worked for a denim factory, because I wanted to understand how denim was working, washing, chinos, garment dyeing, deep dyeing, all the washing techniques. Then I worked 2 years for a very famous Italian brand, working on the outerwear part, because that was something that was missing. And then after, I worked a little bit too long for a French brand that had some license in USA. So I was actually traveling a lot in USA, and because they had the agreement with a department store. So I was every year, 4 times a year in USA, then 4 or 5 times a year in Asia, because all the production was made in Asia. Mm-hmm. And that was the end of what I could do in fashion, you know. And then, because I was not in line with producing in Asia, even if there is some very good factories, but what I saw over there, I really didn't like it so much.
In what way? It was the way people were treated, or?
Well, that was the factory owner was super proud and happy to show you some floor of 1,000 or 1,200 workers, mostly female, you know, on sixth floor, where a Uniqlo shirt is made in one factory and a Ralph Lauren shirt is made in the next factory at 100 meters. So, yeah, that's the whole population displacement, moving of population, and all those stuff was, I was not in line with it. I was not in line with with what. So yeah. So that was the end for me. And then yeah, that's when I decided to stop and to work it on my own.
And was that scary?
That was not scary. It happened at the part of my life that was not the best one. One of my best friends just suicide, but we were very close and I didn't saw it happen. He was not anymore happy in his job. And so that was also a very big wake up call for me because that was many years. I was not happy in what I was doing. And so that was in April. I stopped working for the company I was working with in June. And I spent the summer, July, August, and September, thinking about what I could do. I fakely tried to find a new position, but I was not believing in it. and then at one point in end of September, early October, my wife told me like, "Hey, what you gonna do? You know, I mean, you have to work. You have a bit of money in front of you, but you're not gonna stay at home and not doing anything." I said, "Yeah, I know. I have to do something." And then she was also really kind of strong. I mean, I was kind of full of excuses. You know, I need a staff. I need an office. I need five people, seven people. And she just told me straight in my face, like, okay, you don't have the balls to start anything. I mean, you're full of excuses and just because you're afraid to do it. So we own our apartment. You have a table. You have a computer. I mean, you can start from here. So, and this is what I do, what I did. I started the first collection. I did everything. I was alone. I did everything myself at home. And after a year, she told me like, "You have to leave the home or I'm going to kill you." I can't see those fabrics, those samples everywhere in the house. So find a space and go away, please. Save our wedding. And this is what I did. And so that's the story was started like that.
And you started just with menswear, Pierre?
2013, the first collection was just menswear. Not a big collection, mm-hmm. but representing every category. And that was actually a very good start. I was lucky enough to start with Colette in Paris because Colette was still open. So that was a very good free advertising and with some very good store in USA, some very good store in Japan. So that was an easy, small, but steady beginning. So that was tough because I was alone. I was doing commercial. I was doing invoicing, production, collection, shipping, everything. I had no warehouse at that time, so that was a bit sketchy sometimes. So I opened very soon my first store after just three seasons. I opened the first store in Saint-Germain, Rue du Dragon, on June 2014. I think that was kind of obsession for me to have a store because I thought like a brand without a store was an empty shell, you know, so an empty box. So I wanted to fill the box. I wanted to fill the shell and to have that store. So I think it was important to express yourself, to express the way, the material you're going to choose, the color of the walls, the racks, the hangers, the way you're going to display the merchandise. If the store hasn't been successful, it would have been very painful in terms of financial, you know, because I was not that big at that time. So that was a bet, you know, on the future. But it also gave me a lot of visibility and credibility. And that small store is still the number one store in of all our seven stores. So it's a store I basically built also myself. I mean, we did it with my wife. We had no architect. We are just companies that were working for us, and we did everything, you know. So I understand that.
I also think it's important because you're right in front of the client. It's hearing exactly from the client saying, "This jacket is too tight. I can't find one that fits me. It's tight around the arms," or whatever it is. I mean, I think that you can't deny that when the client's saying it to your face.
You're 100% right. That's something, that's the feedback we can have through a wholesale account is never the same as the one you can have face to face. And I spent a lot of time, I still spend a lot of time in my stores every week I'm in the stores. Every Saturdays I pass by. We have two shopping shop at the Bon Marché where it's I go also almost every Saturday when I do a grocery shopping at La Grande Épicerie. I pass and I say hello to the team and I talk with them and I meet some of my customers. So it's really important. It's really important because the feedback you're gonna have. We have some very loyal customer, you know. So some are telling you like, yeah, you know, the jacket you did like 5 years ago with that details, I still wear it and I love it. And you're like, okay, that's a good one. Yeah, yeah. But you learn a lot. You learn a lot by being in the store.
Was it something that was missing from the market, or was it something that people loved the way you dressed, or what was really the impetus of what you do specifically?
It's always, you know, it's always when you listen to someone that build a brand is always telling you that I wanted to do things I couldn't find in the market.
Yep.
With the exception that you have navy suits, gray suits, blue sweater, white shirt everywhere at any price point and with any fit. So that's a little bit bullshit. Frankly speaking, to be really honest, there was a point of view on the quality. There was a point of view on the made in. I wanted to be everything made in Europe. That was extremely important for me. And if I would have been American, I would have tried to make as much as possible made in USA because there is some very good factory, because there is a possibility to do denim on the West Coast, to do tailoring in the center, to do shirting in New York, whatever. I would have pushed the US production like hell.
Yeah.
But I'm in Europe, and I think it's I use only Italian, English, and Japanese material. So I have to import the Japanese material, of course, but the Italian fabric, why would I send them at the end of the world to have it back in Europe, in Paris, in my warehouse, to ship it back to USA or some, it doesn't make sense, you know? I had that carbon print at that time in mind. That's why I decided to do the Scottish yarn in Scotland. That was the Italian yarn I made in Italy. That there was a whole concept behind the brand where we had to be cautious about what we were doing for the environment and also, making sure that we were in Paris, we were French, we are Europeans. So promoting and pushing the beautiful factories we have here in Europe.
And talk to me a little bit about moving into women's wear.
It's happened, I mean, I had the idea very, very, very quickly. I was in the store one day and a woman entered and she passed in front of a coat. And I was looking at her and then her eyes was just like stuck on that coat. And she asked me, I was alone with the store manager. She asked me, can I try the coat? And I said, yeah, of course. We have small size. We can bring you one. And she tried the 46 men's. Mm. And she put it on and she looked at the price tag. And her eyes just rolled like, oh, no. And I told her, I know exactly what you think. And she looked at me and said, okay, so what I think? I mean, you're a bit upset because you bought that coat at Celine in the patchwork. And that's one of the fabric that is on the patchwork. And the coat just cost 3,200 euro because my wife had the same.
Exactly.
She laughed and she said, that's the same material, right? She said, yeah, exactly, in gray and black. And she took the coat out. She put it in my hand and she said, I take it. And that was the beginning, you know, like when a menswear brands does women, prices are 10 to 15% higher than for the men's category, which is just ridiculous. It should be less or the same, but never more. But that's the point of view of the brand. And also most of the brand that does women, men's and women's, they don't use the men's fabric for women's. Because there is, I don't know, like a full legend or something like that say that they are not comfortable, they are too itchy, that you need stretch for women, you need lycra, whatever. The bet that when I started, I said like, what woman likes in the men's line is the men's material and the men's kind of fit as well. So we redevelop all the fits, we work on all the pattern And we basically did some suits, some jackets, some coats using the material we were using for men's. And actually, this is still the best category we have, are jackets, coats, tailoring for women. At a decent price point, there was a kind of hole in the market where a woman could not buy, except on the flea market, except in the vintage store, a true menswear jacket. And this, it's what we did.
And what have you learned about the way men shop compared to the way women shop?
That's two different animals, and that's two different stories. A man, if he's with his wife, is a different way of buying than if he's alone. I think the most important thing, and it's always what I explain to my store manager and sales associate, is the relationship. They need to come in full confidence. I always tell them, like, if there is something they doubt on, they don't feel good in, or they are not sure, don't push for it. Don't even sell it. It's because they need to come back. They need to live with things that they are sure they're going to wear. Sometimes they have a doubt, but they want to try, and that's okay. But they have to come back home. Men have to come back home, look at their wife, boyfriend, whatever, and say, look, I bought this. And she or he going to say, well, that's fantastic. You look good. It fits you well. The colors are nice with your skin, with your hair, whatever. But the men's customer is really loyal. So if you treat him well, if you advise him well, if you're selling things and propose product that fits them well, it's going to come back, you know. He's a little bit lazy sometimes, and he wants to make sure that he enter in a comfort zone in a store where he's going to feel like at home. And that's super, super important, super important. So that's what really we are pushing. Our men's is buying a lot of navy. I'm doing a lot of navy in my collection. You know, Rick Owens is doing a lot of black. I'm doing a lot of navy. So that's kind of normal, I guess. I don't know. I think what I've learned from them, not a lot, except that it's very important to show them. And very often, you know, I'm wearing the Pierre pants, the pleated pants, and very often they are afraid to pass and to wear some pants with pleats, because we told them for like 25 years that they were looking better in plain front pants. So like now we said, like, you have to wear pleats. They're like, they are destroyed, you know, they don't know what to think. So, but when they see it on the store manager, sales associate, they kind of like, oh, let me try and let me see. And it's very difficult to make some time to make them go out of their comfort zone. But when they try something that they like, they come back and they are super happy.
Pierre, on every podcast, we ask our guests what they wore to the prom. And I'm wondering if you had a prom in Vaughan.
No. I mean, the prom is something really, really US, I guess. We don't have a lot in Europe, in certain schools, but it's not as popular as it is in US to be, or in UK, because there is some in UK as well. But frankly, to be really honest, I was living a life when I got graduated, where I was already like kind of an adult, you know? So I was not really into that things. My friends were almost all older than me. They were at the university when I was still at school. So now I passed that thing very quickly actually, without having a special outfit.
I've read that you say that you wear a jacket 300 times a year. Do you have a favorite jacket?
Yeah, dark navy, flannel in winter, fresco in summer. I mean, there is nothing else. That's, if you have to choose one jacket, that's the no mistake one, you know. I mean, you can wear it if you are clever enough to buy the pants, you can wear it in a navy suit, or you can put a chino, you can put a white denim, a black denim, a gray denim, you can put whatever you want. Even a gray sweatpants, you're going to look good. So without any mistake, I would take the navy jacket.
Pierre, thank you so much for talking to me this morning.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for the invitation.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drazda. What We Wore is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.